Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In exactly, 201 characters, here's the pitch. The inside, no-holds-barred story of how Twitter became what it is. That is where we'll start today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
In New York, I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday. It's Tuesday, the 5th of November. Great to have you with us. The Twitter IPO, as you might have heard, is set for Thursday, and the company is apparently pretty confident things are going to go all right. Today, it bumped up the top end of its proposed opening stock price. It's now shooting for $25 a share. That would value Twitter at about $13.5 billion. Not bad for a company that not so very long ago wasn't much more than a very disorganized startup. New York Times columnist and technology reporter Nick Bilton has written the first real history of the early days at Twitter. It's called Hatching Twitter, and it is quite a story. Nick, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This book is, first of all, it's interesting, but it's basically like the creation story, right? It's the origin story.
It's the creation story that's correcting the creation myth.
Right. Well, explain that a little bit, because this whole thing has been, it's Ev and Biz Stone, and really there's so much more.
Yeah, so there's a thing in Silicon Valley where we have these creation myth stories that are created by the founders,
right.
And they are usually something along the lines of, this thing came to me on a back of a napkin and then became a multi-billion dollar company, and there's no turmoil or distress that happens along the way. But the reality is, it's quite the opposite of that, and there is no better place than that than the Twitter story. And the reality of the story was, it was four friends who were working together on a podcasting company that was trying to disrupt radio, actually. And the podcasting company was failing. And the whole company was falling apart, and they actually said, you know, let's try to come up with something new. And drunk in a car one night, Jack Dorsey and this guy Noah Glass sat
together. The forgotten fourth founder.
The forgotten beetle.
Yeah.
And they came together, and they were talking about this idea to be able to update the status. And Noah had this epiphany that he thought, wow, it could make me feel less alone. And that was the moment when it was this aha moment. And led to the creation of what it is today.
And that is the theme through this book, the idea that these four guys, Ev Williams, Noah Glass, Jack Dorsey, and Biz Stone, that idea of loneliness,
yep.
And these guys were looking for something. They just wanted to be connected.
Well, I think it's not just these guys. It's us. It's our generation.
Yeah.
You know, you walk around today and you see everyone, you know, pecking it away at these little 4-inch screens in their hand. And we're all looking to be connected to something. And I think that the big irony for me when I was reporting this book and what I found out was that there was no place that was bigger than in Silicon Valley at the time Twitter was created. And these four guys who were essentially trying to find connection through technology, and it didn't exist, so they built the technology. And in the end, they all realized, or some of them realized, that technology will never actually connect us to other people in the way that human connections will.
Every small company,
mm-hmm.
I imagine, has dysfunction and has chaos and has mismanagement, it must be said, right?
Yep.
But the scale that it happened at this place,
yes.
is crazy.
So that's really interesting to say that. When I set out to write this book, I had no idea that it was going to be, you know, this in depth and
yeah.
this much drama. But you have these four guys that created this thing, and then it just took off like a rocket ship. And next thing you know, you have Al Gore trying to buy the company,
yep.
getting two of the founders drunk at his apartment one night. You have P. Diddy showing up with an entourage of people and trying to buy the company. You have Ashton Kutcher flying them down to his pool with Demi
mm-hmm.
Moore and pitching to buy it. You have all of these people that are surrounding it. And then additionally, you have businesses that are being changed. You have the media industry that's being changed. You have all these things, and they're all trying to figure out what this Twitter thing is and how they can own a piece of it.
A moment on sourcing. You had cooperation from the four principals and from many of the people involved in this.
So originally, when I first set out to write the book, a couple of the principals tried to have it squashed. And eventually, the founders and the board members just didn't have a choice but to talk to me. And I was able to, you know, the book reads like a narrative nonfiction novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I had this incredible detail in there. And that actually came from these guys. And what it was they had spent the last 7 years tweeting what they were doing, you know, sharing photos of where they were on Flickr, putting videos on YouTube, updating their Facebook status. And it had been a very different narrative than they remembered. And it was just really fascinating to be able to use social media to tie those things together.
What was the biggest surprise for you reporting this book?
I think one of the biggest surprises was the fact that there was so much chaos that led to this thing. But at the same time, without that chaos, the company wouldn't exist in the way it does today. Somebody was asking me recently, should they buy the Twitter stock? And I said, you should read my book first because,
because
if you're going to invest in this company, you need to know the history of it. And the history of it will tell the future of it, too. And I think that, you know, there has been this is a very powerful company that has changed the world, right? And you don't get to say that about many companies. There are companies that change things. Facebook changed communication, you know, but Twitter has changed everything.
Nick Bilton covers Silicon Valley for the New York Times. He's a columnist there as well, and he has an awesome new book out about the founding of Twitter. It's called Hatching Twitter, A True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal. There's lots of all of those in this book. Nick, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
We talked for a good long while, Nick and I. You can hear the rest of it, including the part where he asks me questions on our website. It's marketplace.org. While you're online, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Kai Rizdahl, you know, just so I don't feel so lonely, I guess. On Wall Street today, a whole lot of nothing. Maybe they're resting up for Twitter on Thursday. I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The stalled merger between U.S. Airways and American Airlines appears to be recovering a bit. The Department of Justice has suggested it might step out of the way if the two airlines reduce their presence at a couple of key airports, which sounds easy enough, right? Give up a couple of gates and landing slots, and the feds will greenlight the making of the world's biggest airline. Jim Burris explains the tension really centers on one airport, Washington's Reagan National.
Think of gates as aviation real estate. The more gates you have at any given airport, the more business you command. Richard Weissong is an aviation analyst with PwC.
So at the larger airports and the more congested ones, gates are the primary restriction on how many flights you can fly.
So what does it take for a new airline to get one of those highly prized gates? They have to go to the competition.
They have to find an airline that controls a gate that's willing to sublease to them.
It's called a gate swap, and at Washington Reagan National Airport, that swap amounts to a pipe dream. Gates are scarce, demand is crazy high. Michael Lum is with Sixel Consulting Group. He says no carrier wants to give up that cash cow.
Allowing another airline to use those gates would invite competition.
That's why American and U.S. Airways might be reluctant to give up a gate. They're also hesitant to shed landing slots. Combined, they control about 70% of takeoffs and landings at Washington Reagan. The DOJ wants some of those slots back, in the process incubating more competition. Bad news if you're the airline, not so bad news if you're the passenger.
As a general rule of thumb, the more competition, the better it is for passengers, because more competition generally translates into lower airfare.
Ann McDermott is an editor with FareCompare.com. She says airlines are a complex industry, but they still operate on basic market principles.
With less competition, the airlines are in the driver's seat price-wise.
And in a tight market like Washington, D.C., that's exactly where they want to stay. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Among its many evils, Google is often accused of encouraging the rise of the machines, making search engines so smart, just for instance, that they know what we're looking for before we do, practically. But its latest venture is trying something of a human touch. Google Helpouts, they're called. They can connect you via video chat to experts who can offer help in a number of different fields. For $10 a whack, you could learn to draw, you could get fashion tips, or sign up for cooking lessons, among many, many other things. Marketplace's Mark Garrison volunteered for a little bit of self-improvement for us.
My wife mocks my frugal haircuts, so this is an opportunity to get style advice on Marketplace's dime. I checked out promo videos to find the right person.
I have had work that has graced countless magazines, and I've helped thousands of people develop a look that's perfect for them.
Sold. $10 buys a 15-minute consult with salon owner James Gartner. His judgment was swift.
Modernize it a little bit. Right now you have a very classic cut, which means it just goes straight up the sides and straight up the top.
So when you said classic, was that just kind of a euphemism for outdated?
No, you know.
Stylist and diplomat. Google gets $2 out of this, or 20%. But perhaps more importantly, to do this help out, I had to blow thick layers of digital dust off my Google Plus account and pay with Google Wallet. Dartmouth Technology Strategy Professor Constance Helfat says pushing people to use these services is a key part of this move.
I think it's a very natural strategy for them because it fits two initiatives they're trying to push forward that they don't have major traction in yet.
There is a big market for this, you know, live help.
Stanford business professor Sridhar Narayanan says Google needs to go further beyond selling online ads.
At some point, that will start slowing down and they need new avenues for revenue.
As for those providing help outs like Gartner, it's an opportunity to make a few bucks on downtime.
You can really get down to the details, whereas with somebody watching a video, you can only see so much before you have other questions.
He even followed up, sending a pic to guide my next haircut. It was David Beckham. No help out would make me look like that. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Along with the big gubernatorial races in Virginia and New Jersey today, there are mayoral elections in a lot of cities, including here in New York. One thread that's common to a lot of those city races is the issue of income inequality, because when you take a local look, that phrase, income inequality, can mean pretty different things depending on where you are. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has that story.
In the last few decades, in big cities across America, the gap between the richest residents and everyone else has been growing wider. Take New York City. Back in 1980, the richest 1% of New Yorkers claimed 12% of the city's total income. Now, they claim almost 39%. But for the average person living in a city, it's not so much those statistics that they notice. It's more a feeling.
The other day, I happened to be walking by the block in Park Slope where I lived in 1990.
That's Kevin Slavin, a professor at MIT who's lived most of his life in New York City. Recently, Slavin passed by a building that used to be his local corner store, a place where people from all walks of life stopped in for conversation, cheap groceries, and heroin, if you wanted that. Today, that building
is now the Cat Clinic of Park Slope. It's now daycare for your kittens.
Kitten daycares where bodega drug fronts used to be, luxury lofts built on former squats, subways where you once had to guard your wallet but now feel comfortable pulling out your $1,000 laptop. On the one hand, Slavin, who's neither rich nor poor, says these changes in the city have a real upside for him. Less crime in many areas, less concern about getting mugged.
I mean, my life is definitely easier to live without fear than with it. It is better.
But Slavin says he also feels like something's been lost as a growing percentage of his city has more and more wealth.
You start to build out the city for that wealth. And there was something that was important and beautiful and worth preserving about living shoulder to shoulder with lots of people who were not at all like you.
There's a price to prosperity that really needs to be grappled with.
Bruce Katz directs the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He says cities like Boston and New York that were left for dead in the 1970s have come back with a vengeance as crime rates dropped and city services improved.
In the last 10 years, I've really seen the flourishing of these places. There are consequences to that for people left behind and for neighborhoods left behind.
But ironically, when low-income families have to move out of a city because they can't afford it anymore, that actually reduces income inequality, points out Ed Glazer, a professor at Harvard who studies the economics of cities. Glazer says the luxury lofts that attract rich people to a city and the social services and public transit that attract the poor, those can be good things that keep a city economically diverse.
The downside, really, of the extremes of wealth and poverty in cities is where is the middle? And the problem is that cities have not been particularly hospitable places for middle-income Americans, particularly those with families.
Glaser says that's the real challenge for cities where income inequality has become a hot-button issue: how to create more opportunities for working families to survive and thrive. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
On this topic, we have an interactive thing on our website. It's called Income Upshot that you're going to want to check out. You put in your income or an income that you made up and a zip code and watch the data match up. How likely somebody making that kind of money is politically conservative or liberal, how much TV they are likely to watch, whether they own a gun or not. And this one's my favorite: what zodiac sign they probably are. I don't know how they figure that one out. You can take a look for yourself at marketplace.org/income upshot. Coming up,
Jesse, bring me the steak bones. They're barely eating the bones. I need them for the soup.
Another in our series, First Jobs. But first, let's us do the numbers. Markets were mixed today. Nothing too dramatic, though. The Dow Industrial subtracted about 20 points, a tenth of 1%, closed at 15,618. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ added 3 points, not quite a tenth percent, 39.39 there. The S&P 500 shed 4 points, about a quarter percent, closed at 1762. AOL's profits fell, not on write-downs for its patch local news service, but revenue beat expectations and AOL shares surged 8.5%. Fashion brand Michael Kors layered on almost 6% today after it raised its earnings estimates. Homebuilders fell after JPMorgan Chase said orders were slowing down at D.R. Horton. Horton shares off 2%, as were KB Home. The Pulte Group lost about 1.75% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Conference Board releases its index of leading economic indicators. The Family Online Safety Institute convenes its annual conference in Washington. Agenda topics include teen identity theft, child psychology, and the effects of technology, and international approaches to online safety. And it's Saxophone Day, marking the birthday of inventor Adolphe Sax on November 6, 1814. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We hear a lot about kids and bullying. Not so much, though, about bullying and grown-ups. Enter now the Miami Dolphins of the National Football League. Dolphins offensive lineman Richie Incognito has been suspended indefinitely for what are reported to have been racist and threatening text messages and voicemails that he sent to teammate Jonathan Martin. Martin has left the team. The Dolphins and the NFL say they are investigating. But football is not the only job with a bullying problem, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Workplace bullies are everywhere. Google it and you'll find groups like the Boss Whispering Institute working with aggressive execs. Dr. Laura Croshaw is the boss whisperer.
I worked with a surgeon once who, during the surgery, would become so frustrated with the assistants that he would shout at them and throw instruments, which does not bode well for the patient.
Or anyone else in the OR. She says a lot of the bullies she works with aren't evil people. They often have been treated badly in the past.
You think of organisms that, when threatened, to respond with fight or flight. These are people who fight.
According to research from the Society for Human Resources Management, half of businesses in the U.S. report bullying in their workplace. We're talking people who harass and intimidate, isolate, are cruel. Not the jerk in the next cubicle or the boss that once lost his temper. Dr. Gary Namy heads the Workplace Bullying Institute. He says there are a couple of reasons workplace bullying is common.
It's sort of the American style of management, aggression.
Top-down, take-charge bosses are rewarded. Toughness is revered.
The trouble is we don't draw the line at cruelty. We don't have the systems in place to recognize it and distinguish it from what people really need to do to manage.
And he says young workers who get beat up on by bosses and are expected to keep quiet about it?
That's the kind of person who, when they are promoted, cannot wait to be a boss to basically reverse all those trends and get back and say, now I'm a boss and now all hell shall break loose.
All of this workplace bullying has costs. Some people will just leave. Exhibit 1, 6'5", Jonathan Martin. Other times, says Georgetown business professor Christine Porath,
it sucks the cognitive resources away from people so they can't concentrate as well.
And she says bullying can spiral and spread if no one steps in to address it. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You can read economic statistics pretty much any way you want to. One person's positive indicator can often be somebody else's sign that a bear market is nigh. But here is one near absolute. Bankruptcy filings are plummeting, down about a third from their peak during the recession. Now, what that means? Well, that's a whole different thing, as Annie Baxter explains.
If being in a terrible financial situation is a kind of precondition for bankruptcy, Joel Hagen and Becky Billings were pretty good candidates for it. In 2012, the couple, who live in a Twin Cities suburb, wanted to declare bankruptcy. They had suffered through several years of rotten job prospects, which came courtesy of the lousy economy.
We've been together for almost 6 years now, and about 90% of that, one of us has been either unemployed or underemployed.
They also had piles of debt. Joel started their relationship with about $30,000 on credit cards, plus a roughly $100,000 mortgage. Becky had that and more from graduate school.
I come with student loan debt.
You each bring something special to the marriage then.
Yes, exactly. Different types of debt.
They managed to dump their mortgage through a short sale, but they still wanted to discharge some of their other debts in bankruptcy. Only problem was, they couldn't scrape together $1,300 to pay a lawyer. And they didn't want to waste money filing on their own in case they botched the paperwork. You've heard of too big to fail? Becky and Joel were too broke to file. As we talk about all this, Becky falls silent.
Not a happy time to recall.
No! I guess I'm just going to cry about that a little. It was hard.
For Becky and Joel, avoiding bankruptcy was not some big financial victory. They still struggled and continue to struggle. Melissa Jacoby teaches law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She says it's easy to think bankruptcy filings are down since the recession because Americans are better off now. Not necessarily.
We don't always see a perfect alignment between good times and low bankruptcy filings.
Jacoby says if the economy were soaring, bankruptcies might actually spike. Credit standards would loosen, and people would take on more risks and more debt.
Some of the highest peaks of bankruptcy filings occur in very prosperous times. That certainly happened in the middle of the 1990s.
Right now, student loans are the only kind of consumer debt that's been rising steadily since the recession. But good luck discharging that kind of debt in bankruptcy.
You have to keep the student loan debt forever and ever and ever and ever.
Becky Billings says that's one reason she and Joel Hagen can't get any relief from bankruptcy today. They're both working now. He does copywriting, she does marketing, they both judge high school debates, but their finances are still precarious. And student loan debt will hang over them for years to come. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We've been collecting stories the past couple of months of people's first jobs before they became who they are. Author Jess Walters has been on the show a couple of times for his books, The Financial Lives of Poets and The Beautiful Ruins, among others. He says he actually started working on his family's cattle ranch when he was about six, but here remembers the job he says really put him into the working world.
My first real job, the first job that felt to me like I was in the adult working world was when I was 15 and I got a job as a dishwasher in an Italian restaurant. One of those classic restaurants with checkered tablecloths and the Chianti bottles with wax melting down the sides of them. I loved washing dishes there. I loved the food. You got to eat one free meal and I would spend the whole time thinking about what I was going to eat. It was classic pizzas and lasagnas and steak and spaghetti. The lasagna maker would make me an extra large one, and I would eat it. And probably, I would guess, 4 to 5% of my internal makeup is still made up of those lasagna noodles. There was an old chef there named Giuseppe from the old country, and Giuseppe would come over, and all he wanted me to do was save him the steak bones that people hadn't eaten so he could throw them in the soup. And the owner of the restaurant would pull me aside and say, "Don't let Giuseppe have the steak bones. The health department will shut us down." And old Giuseppe would say, "Jesse, bring me the steak bones. They're barely eating the bones. I need them for the soup." And it was my first ever workplace politics, whether to give Joe the old bones or to throw them away. When I was writing Beautiful Ruins, which is my last novel, which is partly set in Italy, I kept trying to find a place to have a chef who coveted half-eaten steak bones for his soup, and it never found a place. I worked there all the way through high school and college, and it was probably, other than being a novelist, it's probably the longest career I ever had.
Take a second and send us the story of your first job. letters@marketplace.org is our email. Or you can tweet us the details @MarketplaceAPM.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today for those of you into settling bets the old-fashioned way. Japanese scientists have developed a robot so fast that it can win rock, paper, scissors against a mere human being every single time. Here, of course, is the catch. The way it wins is by cheating. This thing can react so quickly in just a thousandth of a second to what your hand is doing that it knows what to throw out to beat you. So, me, I'm going to stick with what I know, which is that paper always wins, you guys. Also, cheaters, they never win. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off 20 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ added 3 points, up not quite 0.1%. The S&P 500 shed 4 points, about 0.25%. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Candace Manriquez are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.